Hey everyone, quick programming note. James Davis and I are going to start the podcast by breaking down a double slate of MLB action here for Thursday. And then right around the 28-minute mark, we'll bring Chris Durrell on to talk about this week's PGA US Open and the DraftKings Millie Maker. Let's get it on. All right, you're back in the DFSR here with our MLB podcast for Wednesday, June 14th. I'm Doug Norrie, that is
James Davis.
And we're from DailyFantasySportsRankings.com or DFSR.com for short. Still time to grab a free three-day trial to our projection system powered by Lineup Lab. That's optimal lineups for FanDuel and DraftKings MLB. DFSR.com/MLB will get you that deal free for 3 days and then $29.95 a month after that. You are all set to go. Buddy, Wednesday in baseball. It's our first Wednesday podcast. We shifted. Yeah. We added a new day to the podcast. We were just doing Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Decided, hey, we got a little extra time. What? Who doesn't have extra time in their lives? So let's do a Wednesday podcast. Because it just made more sense. It's typically just more a few more games and a few more evening games. Although, in honor of our first Wednesday podcast, there are a few afternoon games as well. So we'll talk quickly about the afternoon slate. There's only three relevant games. We'll include that noon game, and then we'll be on to the evening slate of games. What's it feel like for you having to get up early on a Wednesday for the first time in your life?
It's not easy, Doug. It has been, yeah, I don't know, 4 years or something since I've had to wake up on a Wednesday morning, and it doesn't feel good. So thanks a lot for peer pressuring me into colleague pressuring
peer pressure,
me
I
into.
I just told you what was sense. I just told you what made sense, and then you got on board. All right, let's we'll talk some Wednesday baseball. Here we go, afternoon game. I mean, is there really much discussion after Cueto for early slate cash? I mean, I'm talking about the 3 o'clock. This 3 o'clock, like mid afternoon, really is what it's probably better labeled as. Is there really any discussion beyond Cueto here in terms of pitcher? Will we see him? I mean, at least on probably on both sides, to be honest with you, as like a 90% start in cash games.
I think so. I mean, like, as soon as you start going down the list, I know some. It's been a little bit in vogue recently to play cheaper guys in cash games, although even still not so much on FanDuel. But yeah, as you go down the list, I guess Tanner Roark is potentially in consideration. The Braves have been kind of bad against right-handed pitching this season. They don't really strike out that much. And Cueto himself, you know, going up against KC, it's just kind of a similar situation. And Cueto's just a better pitcher, better track record. I just don't see it. And the Royals have actually been even worse against righties than the Braves have. So, yeah, I don't see any reason. It seems like if you're going to go to Roark, you're just paying a little bit less for a significantly worse spot, and I just don't really get it.
Yeah, Cueto has been fine this year. I mean, 4.3 ERA, really better on the xFIP side, 3.7. His Ks are up a little bit this season, over 81 innings, which is a good sign. Walks are up a little bit too, so he's probably... It appears as if he's sacrificing some control in favor of the Ks. He's really never going to be a huge K guy. Just he works around the plate enough that that's just kind of his MO. Really, everything for him is in his favor for this early slate. The money line's the highest of the early. He's -170. Casey has the lowest implied run total at 3.2 something or other. And yeah, I mean, and he's just not expensive. The bigger problem. It's really what to do on DraftKings in the starting pitcher too. I guess you have to play Roark. Like you'll suck up the 11.7 for Cueto. That's more expensive than he should be, really. But sure. There's probably been a little bit of price correction here, considering it's just such a short slate. And then I guess you just have to play Roark because these other guys, Chasin, Hamill. I mean, Amir Garrett has been absolutely crushed this season.
And really, I was going to mention too. The only black eye on Cueto that some people point to is the home run rate this season. Don't worry about that too much. He's not going to jump from a 0.6 home run rate or home runs per nine to 1.4, given that he pitches in San Francisco. That's absolute noise. So I wouldn't worry about any of that stuff at all. Pitching in San Francisco today too. Like if you don't play Cueto on both sides, I just don't even get it. So.
And the Royals too. Not like we need any more just any more of a case made for Cueto, but the Royals are just pulling one of those bad team moves where they're just like, our guys at the top of the order at the beginning of the season really weren't good, so let's move them to the bottom of the order. And the original guys that we knew were bad to start, let's move them to the top of the order, and we'll just keep switching that around all season long. They're like, Whit Merrifield, you're going to bat first. Now you're ninth. Alcides Escobar, you're going to be ninth. Now you're first. You know what, guys? Swap back. You guys swapsies. You guys go back. Moustakas, you're going to be our second.
Eventually.
Yeah, Moustakas, you're going to bat two. Nah, now you're seven. You stink. The other guy stinks too. You're back up to two. You know, like it's just absolute merry-go-round of losers. And this is what just when you see teams like this do this, it just really is a sign that you're a very bad team. Casey's a bad team, and I think Cueto is probably the chalk. On the offensive side of the ball, I mean, I'm surprised to say it. I rarely kind of think this, but San Diego's in play here. And I made the joke the other day. where I think it was either on Twitter or in the chat, I can't remember, but I was wondering what Will Myers thinks every time that San Diego lineup gets put out and he just sees the guys that are slotted around him. Like, because Will Myers is a real bat. And then you kind of look at the rest of the guys and is it like a sense of deep depression? Is it kind of like, I'm getting paid, so what the hell ever? Like, I mean, I'm not really sure what Myers thinks, but do you think San Diego's in a good spot here?
I imagine he thinks the same things Adrian Gonzalez thought back in the day. And when people ask him, they're like, hey, Will, do you think that you're going to be a Padre for life? And he says, like, you know, I have no plans. He looks over at Franchi Cordero. He's like, totally, dude. And he's over. And then there's Jose Perella, who batted leadoff for them the other night. He's like, dudes, like, we're building something here. Yeah, Hunter, Brent, you know, Corey, we're building something. I'm not just going to leave because of one bad season. We're 26-40, whatever. He's not going to stay there. That's the thing. He's not going to stay on this team.
He's a bat. I do think, I mean, honestly, even guys like Perella are in play here just because the righty, any righty bat that you're going to get, be able to get against Amir Garrett, you're never going to, almost outside of Coors, you are never going to see the Padres with like a 4.75 plus implied run line. I mean, oh my God. And it's in San Diego, which really just, if Amir Garrett needed any reason to get sent back down to the minors, someone should just point to the Vegas total in this game and just say, hey, buddy, thanks, but no thanks. Go work it out in the minors. Because
what does Vegas know anyway, Doug? Come on.
Lately, they've been lately not a ton, but no, the run line started at 8.5, or excuse me, the over under started at 8.5 for San Diego. It's been bet up to 9. Most of it coming on the Padres side of the ball. I do think I mean Myers is a great play in the early. Honestly, like if Perella did hit at the top of the lineup, he's in play. Even guys like Renfro and Hedges, they're not very good, but if you get them on the better side of their split here against Garrett, who's very wild.
Well, I'm licking my chops. Names you're throwing out there.
Give me the chance. Again, outside of Coors, you never even think about these guys really. And they would actually even need to have a bad matchup in Coors for us to kind of go down the well, but I think this is a spot on a short. And again, it's a short slate. Like if real good teams were here, then I don't think we'd be considering the Padres. But the other offenses that are going here, I mean, the Reds, they don't have an amazing matchup here against Chasen, considering the park. We already said the Royals are kind of out of play. The Giants just really aren't that good of a hitting team in general, and they're kind of expensive. And then you have the Braves, and then you're gonna use the savings of the Padres to play the Nationals, right? So I think like that's probably the plan I would use going in. So no, I'm not excited about the Jose Perales of the world. Neither was Will Myers, but there are days that you can play these guys. Do you see using that savings to pay up for the Nats here, even against Tehran?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, even against Tehran is used to mean something more than it does now. Tehran, you know, of course, made his big gains last year, increasing the K rate, lowering the walk rate. This year, it's gone in the opposite direction. His Ks are back down under 7 for the first time since his rookie season. The walks are at an all-time high. He's only 26 years old, so it's kind of strange to see him falling apart this way. But what you really like for him, from a stack purposes, in terms of stacking against him, is the ground ball rate continues to drop too. So he's given up a lot of home runs, a lot of hard contact, putting guys on base. There's not really a lot you can say nice about Julio Tehran right now. Like, I just feel like if he weren't Julio Tehran, this guy who was supposed to be a huge prospect, who's had some actual success in the past, the Braves might be considering even moving on from him. So I wonder if even there's some injury stuff going on. There's something weird with Tehran from my perspective. And yeah, I'd be excited to be all over the Nats. Like, even on a big slate, I'd be excited for this spot. So yeah, I think stacking San Diego and Washington, maybe then you sprinkle in one Cincinnati guy here and there, is a pretty good winning recipe today.
Washington did do their classic, even though they had batted Harper, kind of saw the light, batted Harper second a couple games ago, and then went right back to just hitting Ryan Rayburn in a righty-righty matchup second yesterday against Dickey.
Oh,
now,
my God.
It worked for them because they scored 10 runs, but that's one of the evaluate the result, don't evaluate the process kind of thing, because, I mean, I don't know if they just saw something, like Dickey has reverse splits, but I'm not positive about that, but no, they still did it, still hit Rayburn second. I do think you do see good when they hit second here. If not, then they move Harper up to the second hole, and then you just move everyone up one. So guys like Turner, Harper, Murphy, Goodwin, if you were to bat second, all very much in play for the early slate. I think that's pretty cut and dry, and I do think that's not going to be a secret here for the early. I suspect that's where most people go. All right, let's move to the evening slate of games, and we can start with some pitching here. The biggest name and the most expensive name, and this, I mean, honestly, it could be a very much like the early slate situation here with one name standing out, though I'm a little worried about the matchup, is Kluber. Do you think Kluber at 10-2 on FanDuel is still pretty low for him? Do you see him as being I mean, is he just going to be like another just kind of clear chalk play, even if it is against San Diego?
I think as you're looking at the other options, you know, like we laughed about exactly this maybe on last Thursday's podcast, but when the next expensive guy is Irvin Santana, then Kluber starts to look a lot more attractive, you know? especially if you're looking for safety, which we often are in cash games. And, you know, as a reminder, something we mention frequently, but the bigger the slate gets, the more likely we are to get like a Jose Perella type guy, some cheap guy who's a pretty reasonable player who's batting at the top of some lineup. So you don't even actually really need that if you're going to play Kluber. Like, you can actually afford to still get reasonable bats and pay $10,000 on FanDuel. Los Angeles isn't an ideal matchup for opposing right-handed pitching, but it's really not that bad either. You know, they're kind of middle of the pack this year in terms of WOBA against righties, and the K rate is still quite high. So, all in all, this looks like a great spot, and I'd be happy to plug him and play him in any format.
Yeah, after Kluber, the list gets a little rougher. I mean, I take it back. Pineda is probably a good play, but where do you see him coming in terms of price? Like, do you think he's just too expensive here? His peripherals still remain solid this season, but the price has just come up. I'm not sure if they kind of bumped him up because, at least on DraftKings, he's the only other really solid-ish arm on the slate because he's over 11,000. But is he just getting almost too expensive here, even to like try to roster with Kluber?
I mean, yeah, well, it shines a light on, at least for FanDuel purposes, why Kluber is such an elite play tonight, because he's the only one that really combines good peripheral stuff with a solid matchup as well. Pineda, for a pitcher too on DraftKings, I think, yeah, I guess you don't want to pay up for a guy who's just minus 137. That's not really where we want to be. And the Angels are one of these kind of middle ground matchups where their WOBA against right-handed pitching is below league average, but they also don't strike out very much, so... And they're well below average, I should say, in terms of the WOBA against righties. So from that perspective, he's pretty unlikely.
You figure that drops off a cliff without Trout, too.
Definitely, yeah. And so they're pretty unlikely to just blow Pineda up, so you really, really like that. I mean, it's so hard when you're paying up for kind of a more speculative play in your pitcher two slot. You generally don't feel very good about it, but I'd say Pineda just barely clears the bar for me in terms of moving from a more speculative guy into something that actually is pretty safe, even if it's a little bit expensive.
No, it's a good spot for him in terms of better. It's a park move in the right direction for him getting out of Yankee Stadium and going to Anaheim. The K's are still there, 9.5 K's per nine. He's cut down the walks from last season, which has been good. He's just been a good pitcher, bottom line. I'm actually a little surprised about the money line here for him, just considering even just like the public nature of the Yankees, plus that they've been pretty good lately, plus it's a Troutless Angels team. So yeah. I don't know. Minus 130 kind of strikes me as low there, but I don't know if we see that move at all. It actually started at 135 and went down. I mean, Matt Schumacher is fine, I guess, but that money line strikes me as low. But that money line is going to be awfully hard, at least on DraftKings at 11,000. It's different on FanDuel. He's only 8,700. If you pay 8,700 for 8,700 for Pineda here, gives you, I think, a ton of upside if he really gets it rolling. For like, very few strikeout guys with his kind of peripherals exist in that price tier usually. Sure. And he's kind of just been hovering in that price tier for the whole season for, I'm not really sure exactly the reason, but I do think he's a pretty acceptable pivot off of Kluber in tournaments, just because you really what you're looking for in tournaments is the win, and which is going to be a binary thing, like someone's going to get it or someone's not. And then if you have K upside, and the other guys in his group, like the other guys in his price group are Dylan Bundy, no. Matt Schumacher, no. Harvey, no. I mean, Mike Leake is somewhat interesting, but I mean, Leake was going to be a guy I went to next. What do you think about him for a starting pitcher too?
Well, I was going to actually go into Dylan Bundy, and not necessarily because it feels like a safe starting pitcher too, but I do think he's a pretty interesting guy, at least for big tournaments and potentially for cash games as well. So let me give you the quick case on Bundy. So Bundy this season added a slider for the first time in his major league career. He's thrown the slider 21% of the time, and this season's actually been pretty terrible for him, as we're all very well aware. Now, he's been throwing the slider a little bit less in recent starts, and the thing about the slider, it's a weird pitch because, yeah, it can generate swings and misses if you have an elite slider, but if you don't, you can just kind of get rocked. And he had a four-game stretch in the middle of the season where he didn't get more than 3 Ks in a start. Two of those were against Boston. One was against the Yankees. One was against actually these same White Sox. But outside of those four games, I mean, it's fully a third of his starts, so I get that you can't just ignore four of his starts. He's been kind of the same guy he was last season. And now, listen, he wasn't phenomenal last season either, but I do think Bundy, I mean, he's so young. He's got so much potential. He's flashed huge K upside in the minors. I would be stunned if he went from a guy who is just striking out double-digit guys per nine in the minor leagues to all of a sudden being a sub-seven guy after doing almost nine last year. Like, it just, something doesn't quite add up for me there. I do think that Bundy will return to form on some level, and the White Sox to me actually represent a pretty strong matchup here. You know, they're actually bottom three in the majors in terms of WOBA against right-handed pitching, and a top 10 team in terms of strikeouts, and they never walk either. That's really the thing I love here. Their walks are the lowest total in the majors, so in a lot of ways they represent an ideal matchup, and I do think that raises Bundy's floor at least to where, you know, again, if we're going to speculate on some random starting pitcher too, I think he's at least in play. All that said, I'll still take Pineda. Like, I think Pineda's in a better spot and has a higher floor, but I don't think we can just dismiss him out of hand.
No, I'm with you. The park doesn't help Bundy, but I mean, his home park doesn't really help him either, so that's not...
No, yeah, it's a lateral move.
The White Sox really don't have any lefty power at all on their team. Like, you know, they have Yoelmer Sanchez and Melky Cabrera, who both are switch hitters who are batting to the top of the lineup, but that's not really, they're not really scaring at all. And then it's pretty, basically righties all the way down after that. So, no, I do like that play. Watch out for the weather there. There is some rain in the forecast.
Sure.
You know, the guy that I was kind of trending toward a little bit, maybe starting pitcher two wise, in that same cheap kind of area, was Leak, who I kind of just mentioned a second ago, kind of for the same reasons. Like, Milwaukee is a team that will strike out a decent amount. They're still without Braun. They've been kind of, I don't know, shuffling their lineup around a fair bit, especially at the top of the order, really kind of the whole season. They kind of, like, you know, they've worked in Sogard and some other guys there. They're a team that, you know, like I said, they will K. Leak is not a huge K guy, but when you face a team like the Brewers, 25% K rate against righties this season, I think there is a slight case for him. Again, he's not safe by any means, and he, like, I don't know, he's just not an exciting pitcher. But if
what, a 6K rate doesn't excite you, Dick?
Yeah, he doesn't walk any guys though too. Like, he's a guy, yes. He's able to keep the ball, like, kind of just, he's hoping to keep the ball in the park and may have guys make contact, and that's kind of his MO. No, I don't love him. I'm saying just in terms of if you're trying to work in some salary to fit with Kluber, you get a decent money line on Leak at -160, only four or so implied runs for the Brewers. So I think you're kind of, like I said, it's a not sexy, safe ish pick without really me being, you know, too over the moon about it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, again, you're gonna have to kiss somebody's sister in that second pitcher slot, as we like to say. And so, yeah, with Leak, it kind of feels like kissing your own. But I think at 6,800, I mean,
I didn't realize it could be anybody's sister. Shoot, I take that back. There's plenty of other people's sisters.
You have to kiss yours. Sister. Is what I was gonna say.
Yeah, never mind. I can think of some sister. I'll tell you off the air.
Sounds good, man. But yeah, with the thing about paying up for Kluber, he's, I think you mentioned this, maybe on yesterday's podcast, but maybe even today. About Cueto, actually. 12.5 is more than we want to pay for Kluber, generally speaking, but actually pairing him with a guy like Leak or maybe even Bundy does help you kind of get away with that a little bit better. And actually, while we're down in this same echelon, I was kind of looking at Brian Johnson, you know? Brian Johnson, I know you're not the hugest Brian Johnson fan, but he's got two good starts under his belt so far this season and got chased before five innings against Detroit his last time out. He's actually even cheaper than Leak. Is there any merit to taking a look at him tonight?
I mean, Vegas doesn't love him. It's hard, so hard to know about guys like this who, I mean, his track record in the minors has been basically up and down. Like, he had a season where he just walked a ton of guys. He had a season where he kind of worked it out. He had some innings where he was posting 8.5 K rates, and then kind of that just went away. I don't really know what to make of him. I know his ERA is a lot better than his xFIP, so just from an xFIP point of view, I know it's only 18 innings, but from an xFIP point of view, he's just merely just kind of, I don't know, a below average guy. Not a great park for lefties with the game in Boston, but
sure.
I'm not that excited about it.
But you know where you don't have to worry about pitchers, Doug? In-game fantasy. That's right. You've heard of in-game fantasy, right?
Oh, I love them.
Yeah, one of our best new sponsors. We don't have that many sponsors, but they're a really good sponsor of ours. They just come out. And really the thing that strikes me about in-game is, you know, we talk a lot about, a lot of people have tried to innovate in the daily fantasy sports space, right? Like, a lot of people have come along and said they have this or that brand new idea. I'll say about in-game is that they actually do have a brand new idea. This is something that hasn't been tried before in the daily fantasy sports scene. And what they've really done is combined the thrill of drafting every day in daily fantasy sports with the kind of a adding the baseball back into fantasy, right? So the way in-game works is you're sitting there watching your games, you open up in-game's app, you join a contest, and instead of just drafting your whole lineup one at a time, you're actually playing the role of the manager. So you see who's about to come up in Major League Baseball, you select them to go to bat for your team. And when your batter performs whatever result, that actually happens as though a game were being simulated. So in-game's app looks just like you're sweating your favorite team on like an ESPN box score. If Jose Peraza gets up there and smacks a double, well, then he's on second base for your team, and then you bring Trout to the plate next if you want, or Bryce Harper, whoever you think is going to have the best spot, and then they take their cut. If they hit a single, they'll knock a Jose Peraza in. If they get out, your next batter comes up. And so each game lasts 3 innings. You pick each batter. You can take it over the course of a whole night, so you can actually get a pretty significant edge by just targeting the best players that are going on any given night, and you can just have fun, right? Your contest ends, you just enter a new contest, and you can play in-game all night long. I know I've done that at least on one occasion since we found out about them, and we're happy for it. And actually, really cool tonight, Jason Garcia, one of the founders of InGame, is going to be in our chat room helping facilitate a staff versus DFSR users in-game game. So the people who wind up beating the DFSR writers, everyone who beats our highest scoring writer is going to get a $5 entry fee into in-game contest. So look out for that. Come into chat tonight, hang out with us, hang out with Jason, and let's get going. In-game fantasy.
I like how in your wildest in-game fantasy, you chose a guy who hit seventh for the Reds and then a guy who's hurt. So it was the Jose Peraza leading into Mike Trout scenario. So no, I do like the example.
That's cool. Way to call me out. Thanks. I'm sorry to in-game fantasy. Sorry to Jason Garcia for Doug crapping all over my excellent live read.
No, I love in-game fantasy. I think it's great.
Yeah, we'll put you on the live reads in the future, buddy. You're up next. There you go. I'm out.
Joke because I tried to do a live read 2 seconds ago for in-game and I so colossally screwed it up because I was stumbling over my words that James had to come in and do the old bailout. That's why the way you make yourself feel better about a mistake is to make fun of somebody else, and that's a pretty easy, just kind of a elementary school approach that I like to take to things. All right, let's head to the evening slate of stacks. It's been some weird recent kind of like runs for teams that had a high implied run lines and like haven't quite gotten there. Red Sox last night were one of those. Cubs over the weekend. This will happen. It's just kind of the variance in baseball. You kind of just need to live with it. I mean, in general, teams with high implied run lines over the course of a season are going to be the ones that tend to perform. It hasn't been completely the case in the short term. And then, like I said, you get the Twins last night that put up 20. I mean, when you see a team like the Twins who put up 20 runs, the game before,
yeah.
It sure is. Do you think that kind of makes people? I mean, they're in another great spot here again. So, like, I think they have the highest implied run line on the night in the evening slate. Do you think that makes them higher owned than they would have been had they just scored 6 runs last night? Like, still won, had a decent game, but like when they have like this kind of total outlier performance, do you think that that kind of perks people's ears up more?
Yeah, probably. I mean, especially just given that they're facing Sam Gaviglio, I think people will talk themselves into the narrative of, well, they scored 21 last night. What are they going to do against Sam Gaviglio tonight? And that's probably not the greatest thinking, but just a simple fact. I mean, they're still the highest total in the evening slate, so it's a great spot to play the Twins, no doubt about it. I think for cash game purposes, you're going to see a lot of Twins out and about. I just don't, you know, I don't think you have to do it. I think there are other good spots as well.
Guys like Dozier are showing up in lineups right now, Sano as well. So I think that's something, I think that you kind of see that over the course of the day. You might even get like a Robbie Grossman in there. This run line is so much higher. The implied run line is so much higher than really even the next closest team that I do think you see a few more Twins than usual for us tonight. You know, even if they move like Max Kepler back up into the 2 spot, he'd be in a good. They're a team that will shift around the top of their order a little bit. Not Dozier, not Sano, but like that second, the second and fifth spots. Kenneth Vargas too. So a lot of guys in good spots here. Not the best park in the world, but I don't know. Vegas has no love at all for Gaviglio. Where after the Twins do you see? I don't know. Do you see kind of like your eyes going in terms of stacks?
Well, yeah, I think Baltimore actually makes a pretty interesting stack tonight. We've talked at length about this in the past as well, but you know they have a lot of right-handed bats on this team, but a lot of people that are sort of reverse platoon split guys, so guys like Adam Jones, even Manny Machado to a lesser extent, and then of course they have their big bats like Chris Davis, Mike Trumbo's always been decent against right-handed pitching as well. And they're up against Miguel Gonzalez. And Gonzalez, let's face it, since he's been in the majors, has been kind of less than a major league level pitcher. So you throw that together with a good ballpark, and I think Baltimore... What I like about Baltimore, too, is that their whole team kind of has this weird platoon issue where they wind up being priced to their averages, where against right-handed pitching, they're a little bit better. So, yeah, I think Baltimore's, they're kind of a high variance option, but I still like them quite a bit here.
No, there's a, yeah, I'm with you on Baltimore. There's another just total garbage pitcher going here today where I do think you see some people get some money in on the Astros. Andrew Cashner has, let me give you some of his numbers. So, 5.4. Well, the only thing that's even keeping him alive is the ERA, and the ERA is only kept alive because his BABIP has been, he's been running super hot on BABIP, 0.269, which is really crazy hot for 65 innings worth of pitching, and then 80% strain rate. So you combine those together into a 3.17 ERA. The truth is actually 5.47 xFIP. The guy is still walking more guys than he struck out this year. So 4.13 walks per nine, 3.99 strikeouts per nine. I mean, R.A. Dickey was bad again last night, kind of, but I think Cashner is moving into my only starting pitcher that has more strikeout, more walks than strikeouts category. I'm not sure there's another guy. I'm actually surprised a little bit that the run line for the Astros is as low as it is. It's not low. It's like...
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that, too.
It's in the low fives, but still, Cashner has been so bad, and I don't know if, like, this is like ERA informing it, but even like 5.5 implied runs for the Astros seems a little low. Now that is climbing a little bit. It started, it started at minus 145 for them, is butt up to minus 152. I wouldn't be shocked to see that continue going. So their prices have come up a little bit in the short term. Springer's close to 4,000 now. I mean, really all their guys are around 3,500 or above. So you're not like necessarily getting a discount on them. But still, I can't really overstate how bad Cashner is. So this is a situation that I'm just kind of happy to buy, even if I do feel like I'm not overpaying for them, but I'm probably just, they're probably just properly priced at this point for what they've been doing this season. Anywhere else we can look here? Or is that, I mean, that's three teams that are really standing out. Red Sox, I mean, they're kind
of... I have no piece about the Red Sox. That was the one I was going to key in on. Hellickson this season, just, again, remarkable. His Ks per nine are down to 4 per 9, which is just almost unheard of for a guy who can throw 72 innings in the major leagues for a team in a season. That's just true batting practice level where his only strikeouts probably come when people foul off the first two pitches and then get distracted. Someone calls out their name on the third one. I just don't even know. You only strike out 4 guys per 9 and you stay on a major league roster. The Red Sox this season, of course, you know, they're a less lefty heavy than they used to be, for sure. Like, you know, losing Poppy is a pretty notable move there, but they're still a top 10 team in the league in terms of WOBA against right-handed pitching. So they can still crush a righty when they have a mind to, and you know, they're expensive. So it's not like it's easy to just jam your lineup full of Red Sox. It's not the best spot in a vacuum for them, but that actually might make them underowned in big tournaments. So yeah, I'm really big in a Red Sox stack, given that there's some other, maybe slightly more obvious options. I think they're a good one as well.
Yeah. I actually still think Mookie Betts is a value here at 3,900. I know he's kind of getting expensive, but he's been running pretty bad on BABIP this season. He's about 40 points under his career average. He's one of those few guys in the league that walks more than he strikes out. Like, he's just great. And his numbers overall are just being kept a little bit down. Like, you know, 40% more worth of BABIP or 40 points more worth of BABIP. And, he'd be probably like a $4,500 to like $5,000 player, I would say, yeah, just because with the power and the speed. So if you're, I still think $3,900 seems kind of expensive, but for him, it's really not, right? Like, he's got power. He's one of the few power speed guys with an elite on base. He has an elite on base percentage when he's like just kind of not running super bad. So I love Betts here in this spot. I love him as a one-off. I do like the Red Sox in general, though. I like the run lines and a couple other teams better, but he's a guy that I'll happily just kind of load into all cash games. All right, we're going to get out of here. Like I said, I'm jumping out with Chris Terrell right after this to talk the U.S. Opens for some PGA. Buddy, your first Wednesday podcast in the book.
And how did you think it went, buddy? How did I do? On this
I will grade you off the air because it'd be embarrassing for people to hear. I'll talk to you tomorrow for Thursday's podcast. Later, buddy. All right, I'm here with Chris Durrell, DFSR's resident PGA expert, also NASCAR expert, NHL expert, baseball expert. He's a jack of all DFS trades, here to talk about the 117th U.S. Open being played this weekend. Chris, how's it going, man?
It's going great.
Yeah, no, it's always fun for the majors and then for a couple other big tournaments to get reschooled on golf by you, because don't know. I just kind of I put it in your hands. You do a great job. Chris is very active in, with our users. Kind of he puts out just a ton of free content for PGA stuff. I mean, honestly, well above and beyond really what anyone could be considered would be kind of some free offerings for PGA. Gives insight to all of his kind of process. Has a pretty solid database and system that he uses that he basically just, I don't know, open shares with users. So we love him for that. Users love him too. And want to pick your brain about the US Open this week. So the majors obviously draw a ton of attention on both sides. I mean, FanDuel is kind of newer to the PGA game, but specifically on DraftKings, where you're going to have someone's going to be a millionaire at the end of this week on DraftKings just because they have their million maker going. What are some of your thoughts here? Start us off with the course, I guess. I know the course is a big thing for you and other guys that take kind of deep dives into PGA DFS. What are you seeing from the course this week, and kind of like talk about which golfers it's going to favor?
Yeah, so the U.S. Open goes to a new course every year. So this is the first time it's ever been to Erin Hills, which is in Wisconsin. It's a bit of a beast. It's a par 72. So normally the U.S. Open is a par 71, par 70. You're only going to get two, maybe three par fives. This week it's a par 72. We're going to get that extra par five, and the course is actually stretched out over 7,700 yards, and they've actually said they've got enough tee boxes where they could actually stretch it out probably closer to 8,300 yards if they needed to. I don't think they will this week. Originally, I was looking at some things just because the course got very wide fairways, 50, 60-yard wide fairways, should be a little bit easier to hit, so that kind of takes driving accuracy away a little bit. The fescue outside the fairways is very, very tall, so when you are spreading the ball around a little bit too much, you're probably going to be very penalized. Now, something they did change here just over the past day was they've got some rain. So what they did with that really tall fescue is they actually cut it down. I believe it was between like 4 and 6 feet now, maybe even a little less in places, so it's not going to be as penal. But with all this rain, the big change is that these fairways that were normally bouncy and undulated where balls are going to roll out, guys that normally drive 280 or would have probably seen drives go up in the range of, you know, over 300 yards just because the way they would roll. That might not happen now just because it's got saturated with so much rain over the last few days. So something I am changing in my model and my spreadsheet is I'm looking at driving distance a little more now where I wasn't before. So my top five stats are going to be strokes gained off the tee with a little bit of driving distance baked into that. Some strokes gained approach is the next most important thing. Par 5 scoring, because I mentioned there's going to be an extra par 5 this week. I think guys are going to be able to make up their scores there. Birdie or better percentage correlates very closely with DraftKings scoring. And then scrambling, of course. Guys that are going to miss the green are going to need to scramble. The bunkers here are absolutely treacherous. You're not going to find an even lie. They kind of look like, if you ever watch an old golf movie from like the early 1900s, it kind of looks like a golf course just kind of plucked right out of that. The bunkers, anyway.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, no, the course, it's so funny how course and anyone that does, you know, even just football or baseball DFS is going to know that weather, it's not something you think about so often, especially when you're just kind of, I don't know, working around the margins of fantasy. But when you really start deep diving into this stuff, you start to realize that this weather stuff, it really matters, right? And even this, just the idea that behind, you know, what you said about that rough, trimming it down and like kind of what golfers that's going to favor, or like what kind of, if it's going to play, the course is going to play wet or dry. These are things that I really had never, I mean, I probably consider them on a periphery just watching golf with a beer in hand on Sunday, you know, for the finals, but not necessarily when it comes to you know, hardcore analytics and hardcore looks at what kind of golfers stand, you know, just stand to kind of rise to the top. Give us a couple golfers, you know, maybe two or three guys that you think you're going to maybe, if you're looking at cash games, that you were going to kind of anchor those around, or if, you know, if you're looking at the Millie Maker, guys that you maybe think are either chalk plays or popular this week, or maybe even off the board. Who are you looking at in terms of some of your golfers?
Yeah, so in the upper tier, a couple guys I'm looking at just from mostly a GPP ownership standpoint. Number one is going to be Rory McIlroy. He dealt with a bit of an injury at the Players, he kind of complained of some back pain. He took the next two tournaments off just kind of as a precautionary because he lives and breathes for these majors. So this is kind of his life goal, I guess. He thinks his career is going to be defined off the majors. So I'm not really worried about it. Listen to him in interviews. I'm not really worried about the injury. He seems to be okay. And I think his ownership's going to be low. Looking at FanShare Sports and just the tags, it's almost split of guys that are recommending him to start and guys that are recommending fading him. So I'm going to take that advantage maybe in that 10%. If he's going to be 10% owned, where Dustin Johnson for $800 more is going to be in the 20 to 30% owned range, I'll take McIlroy there just to kind of get that advantage. Same thing with John Rahm. I've never seen John Rahm. He's coming off his first cut since last August and only his second cut since last year's U.S. Open when he turned pro, just after the U.S. Open. I mean, he turned pro. He's kind of in the same boat. He's actually leading the fade count on FanShare Sports this week, which doesn't seem right, but if people are actually going to be fading him, I'm going to jump on board because he's an elite player. He sticks out in all the stats on the sheet. I think he's just going to be a great play if people are going to avoid him. So those are two guys for sure for ownership at the top. A guy kind of in the mid-range that I'm looking at, probably going to have a lot of lineups, Matt Kuchar. He doesn't really fit the distance thing that I was just talking about earlier, but he's been very good at the U.S. Open. He's coming in with some nice form. And then going down a little bit further, got a couple guys in the mid-range in that, actually it's below 7,000 this week, is Byunghan An and Jamie Lovemark. Both kind of have that distance right around average 300-yard drives. Both, if you look at Jamie Lovemark, he finished 18th at the U.S. Open in 2015. I'm not looking a whole bunch at U.S. Open history just because it is a different course every year. Things are going to play out a little different, but seeing that a guy has success on a U.S. Open course, which is usually the hardest course, hardest test of golf, which that's the way the USGA wants to make it, is good to see for those guys. And Lovemark's coming in with two top 20s. Byunghan An finished 23rd at the U.S. Open last year and is coming in with an 8th, 5th, and 25th his last three tournaments. So those are three guys in the sub-7K range. I think you could even put together with two of those with Rahm and McIlroy at the top.
Now, do you see the – just going back to McIlroy real quick, you think that it's the injury thing that's going to keep him off people's radars, or people are just kind of – are going to gravitate more to Dustin Johnson, Spieth, and maybe Jason Day guys in that kind of upper tier category? Do you think is it more of a golfer thing, or is it more the injury thing driving what you think will be a lower ownership percentage?
I think it's a combination, but mostly I think it falls on the injury thing. Jason Day has dealt with this before. I think he's going to be another low owned guy just because he's always been have these little tiny nagging injuries, and people just don't want to have a golfer who's going to maybe withdraw in round one, and that just screws their whole lineup for the whole weekend. It just makes it really hard, is kind of what I've been finding. And McIlroy also changes putter this week as well, so that might scare some people off. But, I mean, these guys are professionals. He's using the same putter that Dustin Johnson and Jason Day use. I'm pretty sure he's used it practicing for a few weeks now. He said he's played probably around 10 rounds. So he's been heavily on that putter, I would imagine. So, I think it's injury that people are definitely going to avoid him. Now, that might change. I haven't checked FanShare again this morning. But definitely.
Do you find that the pricing gets a little softer for these big majors just because, at least on DraftKings, where they're just going to want to get more, maybe just soft money in on, you know, not guys like you that are reading about every golfer and knowing about, you know, putter changes and things like that. Clearly, like, you're not the person that they're targeting here. Do you think this pricing gets a little softer in terms of, you know, what DraftKings is trying to put out here, just because, one, they want to fill these Million Maker contests, not the easiest things to fill, for starters, and two, they just want to bring more of the casual golfer in for the weekend because they know this is just going to be a highly publicized event.
100%. Like, you look at the top and there's about six or seven guys that are all priced like within $2,000 of each other. So what they're really trying to get you to do is so that you can pick your favorite golfer, Dustin Johnson, whichever of the top guys it is, you can combine them with another guy at the top. And then you can dip down into the, like I was saying, in the sub-7K range, you're getting guys like Mark Leishman, Matthew Fitzpatrick, Graham McDowell, Pat Perez. They're all in that mid-6K range. And it makes it really easy to make a stars and scrubs lineup with two or three top players in the world to get the public.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the key here. I think that the bringing the public in, and it's good. It's a smart business model. Don't get me wrong. I'm not complaining about the model. I just do feel it just does seem like, you know, some of the golfers you just mentioned throwing in some other guys that you maybe want to root for, and all of a sudden making lineups isn't that difficult. Look, if you want to get Chris's thoughts on the U.S. Open, you head over to dfsr.com. He's got his strategy article up there. He also has some videos that he's made about the U.S. Open this week. He has his cheat sheet that it's just he makes, you know, out of the, again, kindness of his heart, makes available for anyone that wants to see how he's ranked all these golfers. Chris, very big heart, big Canadian heart. Good luck with the U.S. Open this weekend, brother. I'll be rooting along with you, and I'll talk to you soon.
That sounds great.
Later.